Welcome, everybody, to the Diecast Movie Podcast. For this episode, we have a special interview brought to you by my dad. Take it away, Dad.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we do movie discussions where the genre in the movie we discussed is decided by a roll of a die. And also, we do interviews, and today we're doing an interview, so I hope everybody will enjoy that, which you'll hear in just a few seconds. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. And again, if you enjoyed this episode, please go to our back catalog of over 190 episodes. And you can find a lot of other interviews in there and movie discussions and something I'm sure you'll find that you'll like and enjoy because we do a wide variety of genres. Otherwise, without further ado, let's get into the interview. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast. And today I'm joined with the wonderful and charming Tara Buckman, which a lot of you might remember from The Cannonball Run, The Misadventures of Sheriff Lobo, and Silent Night, Deadly Night, besides a whole bunch of other movies and TV shows that came out in the 80s particularly, but also the late 70s. How are you doing today, Tara?
Well, I didn't tell you this before, but I really needed a nap. If I yawn, I don't need a nap because I can't nap. But otherwise, a little cough here and there. Otherwise, I'm perfect. Thank you.
Yes, we're catching her right after when she should have had her nap. So she's given up her nap time to let us interview her. But thank you for taking that for the team.
So I might be a little slow, but I'm ready.
I was going to say, you and I got to meet each other recently at the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, which was, we're recording this on the September 20th, and that was just about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And that was your second convention. The first one was at Williamsburg Nostalgia Convention last year. Both were run by Martin Grahams. And how was it like going for you for your first two conventions and meeting the fans?
The first one, somehow, Scott Ray, my signing agent, got me. And I had for years said no to everything if somebody got a number or somebody called. But Williamsburg was only an hour away because I am in Virginia Beach currently taking care of my mother. And I called him back and went, well, I don't usually do this, but I'm game. And then when we talked, I realized it was nostalgia. Now, oh yeah, I fit into that with all these old actors. I was rewarded in a way beyond what I would ever think would happen with the fans. I have always thought, really, me? I mean, you want a picture, you know, really get a life, or, you know, you don't know me. But it's they knew every single thing about you. You know, I saw you die in this, or and then you were alive and the other thing. And we had time to talk, you know, a little bit at that or in the conventions that Martin does. And it was it was very small convention. So I guess it was a warm up for me. I just came home on a high because I felt like I had given back to a person that they had wanted to meet. You can say one line in an episode of something, one line of a movie, and somehow it affected them. And some people would fly in. It was very rewarding, very. They're just people that you touched, you know. So then they brought me into Maryland, and as you know, and you and I took a picture, and you're very tall, by the way. I thought I'd let your viewers know that. Very tall. And that was great, too, because, again, I did a movie with Adrian Barbeau, and it was a Lamborghini and things, and so Adrian does a lot of these conventions, so they would bring things in that she had already signed, and then they'd come to me to get my signature on the little toy Lamborghini. Things out of the blue they would bring up. It was just rewarding. And also playing with the other actors, you know, somehow I was always seated next to somebody, you never know them, but it felt like to me that I was on a movie set with cast and crew. It felt so good to be back into that creative and environment where people are happy. You know, you enjoy what you do. See, Tommy was my side partner and kept coming over saying, give me some of your energy. Give me some of your energy. It was great.
And I was going to say, one day some promoter is going to be smart and have you and Adrian Barbeau at the same convention. So that way people can just get both of you together, you know, can just see like, you know, who wants a picture of both and get autographs and that kind of thing. So hopefully that'll happen in the future and you guys can catch up, you know, from each other. Cause I'm not sure if you've talked to each other since the movie or not, but at least there'll be a chance to find out what's been going on.
I think they did try in the beginning when I had just done that Williamsburg, but something about her manager agent, I don't think they brought it up to her, but you know, some people have managers that take care of it, you know, and say, nope, don't want you to do this one or that one or whatever. But you know, I'm going to be doing some more and that would be super. Yeah. To do that.
I'm just putting it out there so that way hopefully somebody can get it done for you, to both of you, and have that'd be a great photo opportunity to get both of you together.
Yeah, she's done, you know, all the horror stuff. And so that, I mean, I don't know how many, but a gazillion of them. So that's a big thing for her. I'm sort of, I guess, all over the place, you know, with my stuff. Where do you fit me in?
Well, see, that's the beauty of it. You actually, like her, she's done horror movies and other things, but you've done horror movies, you've done normal movies, you've done comedies, you've done TV, you've worked with a lot of different people. So there's a lot of different areas that you can go to also, I think, and fit in rather well. So, yeah, you can, I mean, you know, Silent Night, Deadly Night, Extro 2, and those kind of things are horror films. So you definitely would have horror clout.
Well, it was interesting to me because I learned so much about myself because in the beginning, I had no pictures. Now, it was the late 70s and early 80s that I did the volume of my work and I had no pictures. I mean, I think we had VHS then, and then you didn't have a lot of, you had no social media. There were no pictures up on the internet, and a couple of years ago, I Googled myself and I went, oh, who has these? So my signing agent, he's a pretty professional person. He's got a lot of people, mm-hmm. you know, that he brings in. And he got all these pictures, things like Chips with Larry Wilcox. And in Williamsburg, it happened that Eric Estrada and Larry Wilcox were there. This time you had Barnaby Jones, really? He kind of knew what to pick. But the one thing about Silent Night, Deadly Night, is like, you know, a lot of these things, like, excuse me, say to myself, oh my God, I'm too embarrassed. I would never talk about that movie, ever, ever, ever. And then one of the vendors, there's a poster of the Santa Claus and then me screaming. And I go, oh, come on, the poster. Somebody comes up with a trading card. Well, I'm number 3. And so I have, then in Maryland, I have begun to realize and not embarrassed because with the fans, I don't like to say fans, I don't know, people like you or something, they get it because it became, I didn't know it became a franchise. I didn't know they put that game out there. I didn't know anything. As a matter of fact, I probably didn't even see the movie. And so my angle here, I realized, all right, Tara, accept the fact that you did this movie because I am the mother of that child that has created all this havoc to do, you know, franchising. He saw me die. I'm the mother that made him. So people actually really remember that. So I it wasn't like I came on and did a couple scenes, you know. It was on the mic. So I realized, wow, I think that's why they might be, I guess, trying to get me into Chiller. I've only learned all this. And then also Charles, what's his name, Rosnay, for the Salem event, because it's about the spookiness, you know?
Yep.
And so there you go. We do different genres, and I certainly can't fit into Star Trek, you know, but it's interesting. I will now speak about it with people of like mind.
Because the horror community is such a caring community. You know, a lot of these people, you know, are thinking, oh, how could people watch films like this? But a lot of them are some of the nicest, kindest people everywhere, and they really help a lot of people out, you know, a lot of real life people out. It's just a way to watch something to take them to a different place, you know, just basically it's just release, fantasy, you know, and everybody has their different type of thing, and that's what they love. I love all genres, and that's why this podcast is called Diecast. We roll a die to decide the genre in a movie we discuss, because there's just too many different genres. I didn't want to be stuck down, but I love horror also. And
I know, I love that, the way you do this, the diecast.
Oh, thank you.
I love the idea. Plus, your kids helped you too. And maybe, you know, right? Or you got, I'm sorry, but I probably should be talking about you, but I love the story of how it began, you know.
Yeah, it started with my children naming the show, and we did most of the first episodes, and then as their lives have gotten busier, it's been more of a solo thing with my eldest son helping me still a lot with editing and in occasional episodes, and my daughter does an appearance once or twice a year still. So they're still in the show doing it. But since you did bring up Silent Night, Deadly Night, we might as well just finish talking about it, and that way we won't forget about bringing up later on. What was it like working with director Charles Sellier?
You know, I don't know that he, there was something about, where did we shoot that? I think he's from Utah. And there was something about, like, he was a businessman, and I don't know how long he had been producing, directing. What a classy guy. It wasn't like a director that gets in your face or anything. It was like working with a great executive, I have to say. He was suave and he was smooth. But you know what he did? And I don't think anybody has ever done this. Except Cannonball Run. At the end of when my part wraps, He gives people gifts. And mine was a necklace with a tiny ruby and a diamond. Wow.
Whoa.
Is so neat. I'm sure it wasn't personal. I'm sure he had gifts. But it was classy, you know, because also, I'm going to say this, it was the first time I showed my breast. And it didn't feel right with Santa Claus. I don't know why. I mean, that's you can do that in scenes, in movies where it makes sense. But, of course, this didn't make sense. Can't remember if Santa Claus raped me or not. I think he just killed me. So I was comfortable. Let's put it that way. He was a gentle, classy man.
Well, that's the one thing. When you have a director, especially when you're going to be doing films with nudity in it, you need somebody that you can actually trust, you know, because I mean, I can't imagine, you know, exposing yourself like that. You know, you want to make sure that you're trusted, you know, and obviously he seems to have done a good job of gaining that trust and also earning it, I should say, and putting you at ease.
Yeah. Like I said, he was somebody you would, why do I say this? Somebody that you would want to work in a corporation, because I don't know what his background was, but at all, you know, so maybe he did something else, you know. Do you know, you know, how long he had been a producer director? And it doesn't matter It's simply that I'm old now, but I would work with him again. You know, I don't know. People older than me are dead now, so I don't know.
Well, I mean, he's passed away too. He died at 67.
Oh, what? Oh, wow. Wow. And I turned 67 October 1st. That's early.
He's been involved as a producer since 1973, and this came out in 1984. So he'd been a producer for at least 10 years. And
didn't he always shoot in his like hometown or state, because it was in Utah?
That and I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But that makes sense. A lot of producers or directors, you know, if they can choose, especially for things that are lower budget, will choose places that they're more familiar with and work with it. He only directed a few films.
Oh, okay. Do you know if he did the franchises? Because the kids, well, whoever watches it and wants my autograph comes up and says, oh, yes. Well, they didn't like the second one or the third one. And, you know, and then they said, but it was all flashbacks and you were in it constantly. Some will say, well, no, the film isn't great, but I love it. You know, of course it wasn't great, Silence, the story, you know. I mean, it wasn't like Halloween was good, wasn't it, with Jamie Lee Curtis? Because I watched that. I was under contract with her.
Yes.
The Universal. Love her. Yeah.
It looks like he's only ever involved in the first one. His other films were Snowballing, The Annihilators, and Encounter with Disaster, which he did in 1979. So this will have been the second film he directed.
Oh, okay. It's interesting how he didn't do the second and third. And I don't know how that works, you know.
A lot of it could be the deals and those kind of things, who had the rights. You think he would, but it could be other. As you know, there's so many different things in Hollywood, how everything goes, gets worked out.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. Well, what do you throw at me? Because I was going to talk about Jamie, just because it led, and everybody knows Jamie Lee Curtis. And when she got that award for best supporting actress in a movie that I couldn't stand, everything.
Everything all at once, yeah.
And why did you produce film that's horrible? I don't know. People loved it. I didn't get it. But I didn't even recognize her for a while. And Jamie and I were under contract. I wonder if I should actually go ahead and lead into this.
Go for it.
I guess I'm, because this is interesting to people, I think. Universal was one of the very last contract systems, just like the old days when Marilyn Monroe or Joan, Betty Davis and all those people, they were under contract to studios and they paid them each week or whenever they weren't working. And then they would put them in the movie. And then sometimes they were loaned out to another studio. Well, that's what this case is. The last Empire, Universal. And so Jamie Lee Curtis, Kim Cattrall, Rick Springfield, a bunch of others. But it wasn't a whole lot. So we were paid each week whether we worked or not. Now, to get to that, I drove out, want to be an actress forever, crying in my heart because I needed to emote. And I got a little bit part on Roller Coaster that came to town here. And the guy gave me, the casting director gave me a line, and then that was shown to Universal. 8 months later, I drove my orange Camaro, $800 in my pocket, nowhere to live. But the director, because they wanted to do publicity, said, this is great. And they put me in magazine, like kind of like whoever was found at Schwab's, that old story. some actress that was found. It was like a Cinderella story. Yeah. So they introduced the contracts department was interested to me. And Zoom, you know, I was never a struggling actor. Every role I've ever done, I've not liked it. I don't know how I became blonde and did that stuff, but it was early 70s. And that was so neat. And so Jamie and I, you know, we'll talk for a little while, and what a down to earth girl. And then it went down, the studio empire went down. I think writers and directors and producers were under contract as well. It was all like the Glenn Larson, Stephen Canal. And so, I don't know if there was a strike or something about it that they just didn't think was fair. Really not sure why it went down. And then I went on to do, without the contract, Sheriff Lobo, you know, so, which was silly too, but they were all silly. It was the 80s, Dukes of Hazzard, BJ and the Bear, Sheriff Lobo. I mean, was there anything serious? I'm sure great movies came out, but that was an era that is like, really? And I was very serious that did those roles, you know. But don't you agree that era was
The 80s was definitely over the top. I mean, that's when you had Arnold Schwarzenegger's rise, Sylvester Stallone's rise. You know, you look at the action movies, which were, you know, everything was turned to 11, you know, and when the 70s was the realistic decade where everything was real, then you had the 80s where everything was excessive and, you know, and it's enjoyable stuff, but I agree with you. There was a lot of things that weren't as serious. There were some things that still came out that were serious. I mean, you had Hill Street Blues, you had Highway to Heaven. So you had things that were dealing with drama in different ways. And there was, of course, on Golden Pond and other things coming out. I'm just thinking off the top of my head of things in the 80s that had a serious tone to it, besides many other stuff.
Well, see, the difference is when you say a line in a stupid role, it's funny to people, but it wasn't funny to me because it wasn't real, you know, like a lot of lines in Cannonball Run, you know, the boobies with Adrian and Bobo and I, and even on Sheriff Lobo. But I remember when 30 something came out, I had had my daughter and I was quitting acting and I went, oh my God, an ensemble that is actually real. These are people about their lives. And I know Hill Street Blues and that stuff was, but that I would have killed for. And that's where we went in the later years. And we're still there, you know, where a line or a piece of dialogue, you can understand that they're talking to their wife or something, you know, instead of hitting you over the head, you know, and doing, it's just the difference of a type of show, and that was the era I was in. So that's what I got, but I got work right away. So there you go.
Yeah, and sometimes I know as an actor, you know, I always think of like Ricardo Montalban when he used to talk about acting, and of course, you know, sadly he was a great actor but got limited roles because of his heritage, and things, and he would turn some roles down because he'd look at him, it's like, oh, this isn't that good. But then he realized, you know, this is the only script I have. I'm not like other people that are getting five or six scripts. And then he would say how he'd pick that script up and look at it and say, you know, this character could be unique. I could play it this way and that way. And he would find a way to have it work because he knows he wanted to work. Because as his other motto was, an actor is only an actor when they're acting. And so it's you know, there was a lot of wisdom in from him, and that applies to a lot of different things. And I think that's the hardest part, is for people to realize that actors like to do the truth, and in some of these things that are not as serious, you know, and just played for like a punchline, as you said, that one line, it sounds funny, but for an actor it could be not as fulfilling as it would be to have something that had some meaning to it, even if it's not a line, even if it's just a the body language, the facial expressions, right, that could have so much more meaning and impact in the production.
It's to a good friend of mine. He's passed. Was a producer. He was a writer. Tarot writers can write. Musicians can play. Actors cannot act. And that is a lonely place when you love being around other actors, writers, and all that. And it's kind of a bummer, but you're absolutely right, you know. And then it reaches some points where you go, okay, got a lot of money on this show, so I can hang for a while. Uh-oh, I need a part. You know, and so you want to work with others is like mine, and two, you need the money. Didn't he do one of those Fantasy Islands
Ricardo Montalban?
Yeah.
He was Mr. Rourke. He was in all the episodes of Fantasy Island. He was the original series.
Because I would imagine, that was Q's character. Look, I didn't watch it, but I knew that was Spelling. Yeah. That did all those kind of shows. Yeah. Which I think I didn't want to go in that area, or nobody asked me.
those are those shows like Love Boat where, you know, every week it was a different set of guests, you know, different group of people with you have a few regulars and then you have all the people that are coming in for the different adventures. So it's,
I have to tell you something fascinating about that. You know, when you're young, you have teen idols. Maybe some people don't. Farrah's poster is posted on people's walls, you know. Mm-hmm. But Bobby Sherman and David Cassidy, I think I was 12 or 13, I don't know, probably 13. I had their posters on my wall. Bobby Sherman, Here Come the Brides, and Julie, Love Me, blah, blah. And David Cassidy from the Partridge Family, of course, everybody knows. So I'm doing Sheriff Lobo, you know, I'm one of the stars. And you have your guest stars come in. Well, Bobby Sherman came in and did an episode. And it's like, and you know, it was just normal, but you were my teen idol. I mean, it never played that with me in my head. But if you think about it, I guess that's what a fan kind of is. That was so neat. And then David Cassidy and I did James Darren or something. Darren did, had a series. Anyway, David and I worked on something together and then we were friends. So isn't it neat?
It is so cool when you get to meet people that you grew up watching, just like me meeting you at the Mid-Atlantic, you know, and then you get and here I'm interviewing you, which it takes it to another realm, like you were saying, where you got to work with them and then you're friends with them. It's the same kind of thing. And because my thing is, people are people, and your right. job was acting, and my job is, you know, is different than that, but your job has a way of impacting countless other lives, whether you know it or not, because, you know, in theater you can see it, but in TV and film you can't see it, but you find out, as you said, when you went to Williamsburg, when you went to Mid-Atlantic, and people are coming up to you, and here you're like, oh, this silly little movie, they want to ask me about that, but then you find out they really care about that silly little movie, and then you realize maybe that movie isn't as silly as I thought because of the way the way they got the feel, and it changes your whole parameters.
Well, exactly, but to me, it is silly, but the fact that they, just what we're talking about, and this is the theme of who I am, just because somehow it touched them, made them laugh, made them cry, or whatever. And if they'll tell me something, which usually they always tell you more than you know about yourself in a role, you know, sign this Tara Buchman, and then you put your character's name. What was my character's name? Oh, it was Jill. And that was just lovely. Now, I wish Sheriff Lobo, you know, those pictures could be set on the table. But I learned this recently, that because, you know, people are watching Kojak, or somebody put a picture of Barney Jones, Chips always, Buck Rogers. Well, I only did one episode of some of those, but because they play all the time, Sheriff Lobo, apparently, and BJ and the Bear, you probably know this, but I just learned it. You have to have 5 seasons to be franchised. So therefore, I'm just shocked somebody goes, oh, I remember that in Chips. Oh, I loved you in that episode or this episode of something else. Going, but I did 26 shows on Lobo. Oh, come on, I'm talking about that. So it's because of reruns. I mean, you've got young people looking at this stuff today. They weren't born when these things were made, you know?
Yep.
So there is a following.
Yeah, because The Misadventures of Sheriff Lobo, you became a series regular, I think, in its second season, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember watching that show growing up, you know, and enjoying it, you know. It just, it was a comedy. For those that aren't familiar with it, it's like a normal comedy. You go there, you just enjoy it. It puts a smile on your face. It's nothing earth shattering that's going to change your world, but it helps lighten that load for a half hour.
Well, I think that's what the 80s were. And it's more interesting. I'd love to study this of why were shows like that continuing to be made and people watching them. And someone said to me, whatever was happening in the world, they needed relief to just laugh. I don't know what was going on before that. The 70s was pretty heavy, you know, with Vietnam, you know, ending, and then the colleges, pepper spray, and John F. K., way before all that. But apparently, they needed laughter somehow. That's what I heard.
I think so. And it's like everything. When certain things hit success, everybody wants to replicate the success of other stuff. So, of course, you get the copies. And I think that's what also happens as everybody wants to do. They see something's working. They want to make it the same way.
Well, that's what happened at Universal under contract. They just recycle a Beretta show into a Kojak show into a, you know, the same theme. So, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Just like we have
like I said, I got work, and I'm very lucky, you know, that people are out there for 10 years as a waiter or whatever and just need one break,
yep.
You know. So, yeah.
One person to see him and champion him. But since you did bring up Sheriff Lobo, what was it like working with Claude Akins?
Well, I don't think Claude wanted to move into that area of the show, moving to Atlanta and hire other actors, other characters. Claude Akins, I mean, he's like, well, not kind of like Dean Martin, but he had been around,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing shows. So here we are. You've got me, a little blonde, even though I played the smarter role, Brandy, besides Peaches, my cohort. And then Mills Watson is a great actor, but he had to play really stupid. I just don't think that he... like this. I don't know. You know, I mean, I really don't know. We had fun. Then there's Nell Carter and Nick Costner, unfortunately, died this past year. I think you would have seen him at one of the conventions. We spoke to Brian Kerwin, and I called him and finally tracked him down. And he doesn't want anything to do with this, you know, the autographing or film or TV. But I didn't really work with Claude because it was just funny stuff. I'm sure I did, you know, but half the time you can't remember.
Yeah. You know.
Oh, sorry, I can't give you any info there. I have it on Burt and I'll need him and all that, but I just don't have it there.
Oh, I mean, that's we asked the questions that we don't know, but the thing is, as you said, the show changed from the first season to the second season, and sometimes, you know, there's feelings about that, and even though they're not justified to the new people that came, you know, it's just the hard feelings he had from things being changed, as you said, that could have been there. It's hard to say what was going through his mind.
Well, adding to that, they needed to bring the ratings up, and that's why they brought other people in. And then prior to that, there was an episode where Mills and I had a lot more scenes together, and one of the writers and producers said if it had gone on to another season, they were going to write a bigger part for me because they saw some comedic value in there. And that was really cool, but that's when, you know, everything changed. So,
and I will say, Mills Watson, this is one of the few times he's not the bad guy, because usually when you would see him in other shows, like he'd be there for an episode or if he was in a movie, he was usually a heavy, you know, and that kind of stuff. So this is one where you got to be on the side of the law, you know, literally.
Playing goofy, really goofy. But, you know, at the end of the season, he and I got together and took his boat over to Catalina. And, I mean, we didn't stay friends, but, yeah, I got to see the real side of him. And that he was neat. I just feel bad for him. He played that role. But then again, he probably made a lot of money. He became a star, you know. So, you know, who knows? Maybe he enjoyed it. You don't know. That's why this is all interesting, to find out what is behind all this when you do something.
Oh, exactly. And speaking of doing stuff, you worked with Hal Needham a lot. You know, I mean, starting with Hooper and then and going into Def Car on the Freeway and of course, the Cannonball Run. You know, you besides other things, how did that all start? How did he find you? How did he discover you and start casting you in some of these different movies?
Yeah, interesting story, because when we were under contract to Universal, I don't think they loaned me out much, but the head, Monique James, was the head, but I was assigned to the second agent. Monique handled Sharon Glass and, you know, people that were up there. And so Monique called me into her office and she said, Hal Needham, Warner Brothers, wants to interview you for a part. And I didn't know who he was or anything. So I go to Warner Brothers, to his office, and it's him and his assistant. And there's a picture of me on his wall. One picture on the wall. He said, I want that girl. It was like, okay, I guess, you know, you just know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he and I actually, I'm trying to think about how it all evolved. We dated. He was like 28 years older, but I'd always had a father complex. It was just the guy was so fun, down to earth. And I didn't grow up in Hollywood, and I'm just a normal person, but, you know, I don't have that air about me. And we did date. I mean, it was, and actually I would come over and live in, and he was Burt Reynolds' best friend and stunt coordinator. And Hal lived in the guest house of Burt's house, which is huge, you know, in Beverly Hills. So I would be there a lot and Burt would come down. But Hooper was great. That was a story about him, really, you know, Burt playing Hal. And then Hal had the best stunt organization ever, Stunts Unlimited, then there was Stuntman Association. But those were tough guys. And then Death Car on the Freeway. I don't think we were together. I mean, it was, that was his first television show. So he cast me in a part, which is one of my favorite parts, I have to say, because I die. It's this killer van that chases all, you know, cars and then kills them. But I'm on my deathbed. I think it was Shelley Hack comes in and tries to interview me about this person, trying to get all the facts for me as I'm dying and I can't remember. And it was a scene that my mother told me she could not watch, you know. And other people have said that. And even a fan came up to the table and said, I watched one of the shows, episodes of something, and, you know, I loved you there. Then I watched Death Car on the Freeway. She dies. Oh, my God. She's dead. And then another movie, maybe Cannibal. Oh, good. She's alive. You know? And then I did my own. I didn't mean to do my own stunt, but I had such great backup with all the stuntmen, you know, chasing on the highway. That van is behind me. And I had done little stunts, like in Hooper with jumping out of a truck to another truck. And then in this case, I was driving a stick shift, and I didn't know how, but I'm going straight down. And I'm supposed to stop, and then the stuntman take over to do whatever he does, car wreck or whatever. But I did a 180. I hit the brakes and did a 180 and stopped like that. I think it's going to do, yeah, 180. The stuntman just clapped for me. Wow, what a great job, because I think they thought I was supposed to do it, but that was an accident. So I remember that one. And then George Hamilton, saw him at the convention, and I realized I had, gosh, maybe a small part on a TV series he had done. So I went up to him. I said, I don't remember what it was. Do you? He said, no, I've done so many. And a fan brought up a picture of me and George Hamilton. Not a photograph, but he had cut out a picture of me and George. I went, really? George Hamilton was in Death Car? And then he's around the corner signing autographs. I didn't know, you know, he was there. So they're a cute, you know, hell, it's always fun, you know, always fun.
And that's the thing. I think when you're directing or running the movie, I think the director sets the tone for the set. And you want to get things done. You got to get the work in. But you also want to, I think some of the best ones with getting people to do the certain things are the ones that also want to have fun as they're doing it, and to keep the set a little more calmer, because people, you know, that way, because some directors, I think, you know better than I, it's like you feel like you're walking on pin needles. You hear like, oh, if you say something wrong or do something, they're going to yell at you. And which can make it tougher for you to be able to, and anybody else that's working, to be able to do their job.
Yeah, a tense set is not good. And I don't think I was ever on a tense set, you know.
So. Well, that's good.
But then Cannonball Run came, you know, and I was doing other work or whatever. And if you want to talk about that, we can, because I think most people know that one.
Oh, that's what we're heading for, you know, Cannonball Run, because, I mean, for listeners that haven't seen this, this is like everybody and everybody type of movie. You know, you have Burt Reynolds, Roger Moore, Farrah Fawcett, Dom DeLuise, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Jack Elam, Adrian Barbeau, Jackie Chan, Burt Convy, and Jamie Farr. I mean, it's one of those long, long lists. And of course, you're in it too. And there's probably 500 other people I've left off the list. It was a huge movie.
Well, Peter Fonda came in for a minute with the bikers laying in front of a picture. Dean Martin, you forgot.
I thought I said Dean, but
you probably did.
It bears repeating.
Yeah, because I liked him. Yeah, it does.
Oh, there's people I forgot. I know I left people off, but it's just I can only get so many in with, you know, we don't want to be here just reading the whole list.
I think you did it because I've got the picture. I think you really covered it. You know, Bob Tepfia. But so, no, you covered it.
So what was it like working on that movie? Because, I mean, originally, from my understanding, it was going to be a Steve McQueen movie, and it was going to be more action-oriented, not comedy, but he passed away. They passed it to Burt Reynolds, and then, of course, it became this comedic movie that I remember seeing when it came out in theaters and enjoyed, you know. And, that, and of course, you were on the winning team. You and Adrian win the race. I should have said spoiler warning, but it's too late now.
No, I didn't remember that until Stan came up and told me, yeah, that we won the race.
Yeah, I know. We spoiled it for other people, sadly, but well, it's still enjoyable.
Oh, it doesn't make any difference who wins. It was all the adventure, you know. You didn't care who. Well, maybe you did. I don't know. Maybe you wanted us to win. You know. I love the opening shot, and people tell me that, well, somebody just said it's iconic because I think the opening of the movie, where the credits are, incredible because that black Lamborghini being chased by, Sheriff's car, because the Lamborghini is obviously speeding. And I get out with the stunt driver going, and I get out in this gorgeous red outfit that I can't find a picture of. And I spray a 55 mile per hour speed limit sign. I have spray paint and I put a cross on it, you know, kind of wiping it out. A little curly cue on the side and get back in. People remember that. But I also say, you know, I got to ride in that Lamborghini. Adrian never got to ride it because you had a stuntman. The rest of the show was Adrian and I open the door, get out of the car, close the door, you know, get out with your legs, you know, and your cute outfits. But I got to ride in that darn car. I feel proud of that. And also, and somebody came up just to throw this out and then we can talk more. At the convention, did I already say this? He came in with a real 55 mile per hour speed limit sign. And he had replicated it and spray painted it. And then there was a bullet hole in it. He said, did you know there was a bullet hole in that? No. He said, well, here's the bullet hole I put in. And then he asked me why I did this little curly cue at the bottom of the speed limit sign. I said, I have no idea. So we held it up and took pictures. I just think it's the neatest thing that somebody would do and replicate it, you know?
Is cool. I can imagine if he would have brought like a spray can. Now that you used the spray can when you're there, but to make it look, it's almost like to redo the image. It's like you're like spraying it. You know, that would have been a cool picture too.
Yeah, but I needed to be in the outfit. Okay, so I don't think that would have worked. I needed to be in that purple spandex outfit that was so comfortable.
Well, you can't have everything.
No. No, you can't. But it was really. He was asking the questions like, "Why'd you do the curly Q?" And I go, "Well, I mean, I had an answer, but I really didn't know." Just a fan would even ask something like that, you know.
So. Now, when I talked to Adrienne Barbeau when I interviewed her, I asked her about Cannonball Run, and we didn't talk much about it because she basically said she did not have a fun experience. Or it wasn't a fun set. And I know from research later on, you know, that there were certain things that were going on between her and Burt, from my Correct. Understanding.
Yeah, I didn't know about that until later. She and I never, like, hung out. We just did our scenes, you know, and somebody was writing a book, talking to a lot of actors that were contract players. And he told me the story, you know, I mean, I don't know how much I would say, but do I say anything?
Well, basically, I guess we could just say they had a relationship and it was not happy memories for
her. Yeah. But she also told me that I just remember because I was so young, you know, she was married to John Carpenter, the famous horror director. And I don't know how it came up, but she just said, well, we have an open relationship. I mean, I was young. I didn't probably understand that. But I did hear about that because I don't really thought about it, but I do. Well, either you do or don't. So why we weren't cast in that second one. And I know now, you know, can't have Adrian without me, you know. And that would have been nice. I could have used that at that time in my career because, yeah, I could have. Yeah. And Farrah was dating the, I'll tell you this. Farrah was dating the cameraman. I'm sorry if I'm getting off track and you can lead into other things, but I think this is a little terrible side note.
Oh, you're fine.
Go ahead. So the movie's wrapped. It's done. And Sammy Davis Jr. has a party and invites the whole cast, you know, to his house and his party. Farrah came, dating the cinematographer. I came. I can't remember who else came. But who didn't come was Burt Reynolds, Dom DeLuise, Roger Moore. I don't think Dean Martin was there. But none of those huge stars came. So I don't think we were, from my memory, I don't think we were there very long. I don't think I got to eat food that was laid out. But his butler on the rail upstairs said, I'm sorry, we're ending the party because Sammy has retired. Okay, excuse me. I'm sorry I don't come. I mean, I'm sorry they didn't come. That's just kind of weird, you know. I'll always remember that. You know, but some people do that in Hollywood, you know. I mean, I don't know. That was bad, but, you know, some people have passed, so I can say that.
Well, it happens. I mean, you know, and now you got to work in that movie with a couple of people I have to ask you about, just because I'm hoping that you had some interaction with them. Jack Elam, because I just love that character actor. He was just amazing. Did you get to do anything with him, like, you know, on the set?
I did not. I was always, for some reason, around that scene, you know, him and Dom. And it took forever because they, you know, cracked up so much. I did not work with him, nor did, you know, we're all just in an Atlanta motel. And there's probably only one restaurant or one bar to go to. And we're way out there. But no, I don't ever, I'm sorry. I don't have any information on him.
Yeah, that's what I know in certain things, like, you know, I know like who you worked with in the movie, but it's like, I know sometimes, oh, you're on set or you're both there and you never know.
Terry Bradshaw.
Oh, that was the other one I was going to ask you about.
Yeah, no, we had a hoot and a holler, as he would probably say. What a nice guy. One time, here's what I did. I don't know how we got there. I don't remember talking. And then, you know, it's late. And so I'm going to my room. And I guess I thought we were going to talk or something. But he comes in and he's taking his boots off. And I'm thinking, what? You know, who knows? Maybe he was just getting them off because boots hurt. But I will always remember that. It just was funny. But then years later, he would call me sporadically to talk. And then when he became in the NFL, what are they called? Not the news announcers.
The analyst?
Yeah, on the tech panel. He became that. So he called me. I might have been watching football because I love it. When there was a commercial. And then went back to talk and then came back. That was so funny. You know, because he became a friend that we didn't, you know, you lose sight of. But Mel Tillis, I had met before, because there's a comedian named Michael Arrington that became Mel's protege. And I would go to Vegas to see him. And I remember with Mel, we went to, I think it was called the Palm Restaurant on Sunset Boulevard that had the biggest and the best lobster you could get. But he pulled out his snuff and he had menthol. I said, I want to try it. And so I was chewing snuff with Mel Tillis. Yeah. Got high. It, you know, like, whoa. And super, super person.
Now,
who else did you think asked that maybe I had some interaction with?
Well, that I Jackie Chan, because this was yeah. his second, in, you know, American production. He did Big Battle Creek, and that one didn't do so well, and so they wanted to have another vehicle to get him into the American audiences more in American pictures, and they put him in the Cannonball Run. So you know, like, you guys are in scenes, but you're not, like, near each other. But sometimes, you know, it's because there was the big fight scene and everything else, and just about everybody's there at the fight scene. But that doesn't mean you were there when they were there.
Well, we were all there, you know, because they never knew who they were going to shoot. Almost so many scenes were all there. There's a lot of group shots, you know. But we had publicity. I don't know. There were publicity shots. And there's several out there with me, Jackie Chan, and then Michael Hoy was the top comedian there. So there's one I wish I could get. I see it on this protected site, or Alamy, A-L-A-M-Y. And then you Google in there that picture, and I really want the picture. And it's me in the middle and Jackie Chan on the right of me and Michael Hoy on the left. It's just so stunning because it didn't take long to take pictures. It's just our attitudes and the shape of the picture. I didn't know it was his second. Maybe I thought it was his first. And somewhere when we were doing the pictures, somebody said, and I'm probably absolutely wrong, that maybe in Japan or here, you're not allowed to touch a female actor or not allowed to something. You know, and I'll always remember that. So I could be absolutely, I heard it. But yeah, Michael Hoy was hysterical. And I just think those shots of us were really, really good. So we were close, but we didn't have any scenes together.
I knew they said Jackie Chan was a little upset about one thing, that because he's Chinese, and that they had him playing Japanese. And that was like a mild thing that he was upset with, that they just cast him as a Japanese anyway. But
well, he should have been upset. I would think so.
Yeah, and
you know,
it's just, I guess they were trying to go with the, at that time, you know, Japanese cars and everything, and they were playing up that angle for the comedy effect.
And the market was probably a lot better in Japan, you know, for him and for other actors, you know, in this kind of movie. Yeah. Interesting to know. Did not know that. Now, Dean Martin, I did have a scene with, and I grew up watching Dean Martin because he was charismatic and funny and normal. You just could tell that he was not putting on any airs. And so we did a wrap party picture, and I'm sitting, the whole cast, I'm sitting next to him and my arms over him. And we're in our, for some reason, they asked us to come in our costumes. And he leaned over to me and said, "You wouldn't want to date somebody like me, would you?" And I'm thinking, oh, it's so cute. But yeah, probably not, but maybe a long time ago, you know. I'll just never forget that, because he was another one that I had enjoyed meeting and remembered that I knew something about. And Bert Convy, I already did something with him before, with Man in the Santa Claus suit, Fred Astaire. Mm-hmm. And it was a trilogy. And Bert Convy and somebody else had a story. Me and Gary Berghoff had another story. And then Nanette Fabre, and I can't remember the guy, had another story. But Fred Astaire was always the Santa Claus, and he was in each of those stories, kind of giving a miracle, you know, for whatever the problems were that each one of us had. And it was a Dick Clark production, and I, yeah, I worked with Bert. It's kind of neat when you work with people again out of the blue and see them.
I was going to say, it's like, you know, you never know. It's like, we worked together back a few years ago or a decade ago, whatever the case, you know, and you get to catch up on certain things.
Yeah, except George Hamilton, I didn't even know he was in the movie, and he didn't know where I was. I mean, much older, so it was like not much conversation there.
Well, it does. Everything's different, I think. But even if you don't have scenes together, I think it depends if you're just talking to each other outside of the work, you know, and I think that's where a lot of the memories will click in.
Right. Yeah. So there were a few people, like Tim Matheson was there, that came on our set of Lobo. And anyway, I just had to ask him a question that didn't have anything to do with anything, but I remember coming. He knew, you know, me. So it was really, that's when I enjoy some of those conventions, because you get to meet up with people you've worked with before.
Or you've always wanted to have a chance to talk with, you know, you were always working on different sets or whatever, and you're always like, oh, and then you finally get to talk to each other and get to meet. And, you know, because we're all, I mean, everybody, just because you're both stars, it doesn't mean you don't enjoy each other's work and other things, and you have some similar things that might have happened where you get to talk about it stuff. It's like, you know, like I can talk to somebody about shop with certain things, but other people won't get it. Where if you're talking to somebody that's in that same field, they get certain things right off the bat.
Well, again, you know, a lot of those people, they're doing roles I wish I had, you know, but who knows? Maybe they wanted to be in that Lamborghini. I don't know, you know? Yeah. Maybe well, doubt it, but I don't know.
You know, so. But you never know what people want, you know, but you got did you get to do anything with Roger Moore outside, you know, outside, like, one of the things, did you get any interactions with him?
Only in the beginning, which I can't even remember. We hadn't even started the movie, but I think we were in another hotel all together. So, you know, most of the cast was sitting in the bar or dining room or something. And, didn't talk about much to do of anything, but what a funny man and charming. Of course, then you had all the Bond girls up there. And I'm like, well, I worked with him after Bond. But yeah, I worked with him too. No, he was just charming. I didn't have interaction with him. Who did I have interaction with? Gosh. Well, I'm going to look at this picture. I happen to have here. Well, Bert. Well, there was something about Sarah, but that's not very nice. Yeah, Dean and Alfie Wise, who most people don't know, but Bert gave him
He was in Hooper, too, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Bert helped him out on everything. I think he had a hard time getting work because he's a short guy, you know, mm-hmm. Strong voice, and Bert just helped him, and he and I became pretty good friends. Funny guy. Well, I'm looking at the picture. Yeah. Dom DeLuise, I did go to his dinner, and he was Dom. I mean, there's nowhere to Dom. That's Dom. That's the way he is.
I still enjoy his Captain Chaos. I mean, that was just funny routine. How he would just change from the meek, mild-mannered guy to Captain Chaos, and chaos would ensue, and it was fun. I mean, I was 12 years old when I saw the film, so it was just one of those enjoyable things. And I think you gravitate to him because he was the big kid. I didn't always like the way Burt Reynolds' character treated him, but he was a big kid.
Yeah, that was spontaneous, you know, that they did that, and they both cracked up, and then they went on and on with it, you know, and it was like, okay, enough, you've done that enough. But fascinating that you would be interested in Dom, because that just, for me, was something that didn't work, you know. But, like you say, you were 12 years old, you know. Yep. That's a cartoon character, or that's a
superhero.
Flash Gordon or something.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's, when you're doing a movie like Cannonball Run, you're trying to appeal to just about everybody. I mean, you're casting people to hit all the slots, and you're putting things in. So that ticked off a box, and whatever, it worked for me.
You know what? It did work, and now that you've said that, I never thought about it that way. There was something for every, there was a flavor for anybody's taste. Yeah, you're right. It was. Good point, Stephen.
Oh, thank you. Every so often, like a blind squirrel, I find a nut. I find an occasional nugget.
See, the thing about these, you know, talking to the fans and like talking to you, I learned something that's so interesting after not speaking for 40 years, you know?
Well, you shouldn't have taken that vow of silence, you know? It was so... At least we got you out of... At least we got you speaking now.
Well, I didn't mean to. It was the early 80s, and I was... Again, I don't know how I became blonde, because I'm not blonde, but I played a lot of blonde roles. And then in that era, they wouldn't hire me for a mom. I'm 38 years old, you know, because I would say I was pretty, okay? But I was serious. And I couldn't get those kind of roles. And then I got pregnant, and I had really needed work at that time. And I just said, I want her, my Haley Wayne Buckman. And... I didn't marry. I wasn't with a boyfriend. I just, got pregnant. And he wanted to be around, but it was just so short that, let's put it this way, he's not in her life. And wasn't. And that meant I loved being pregnant. I loved raising her, but I'm only parent, not one that gets all that money. And then went on to do a job. But in my heart, well, raising her took time, you know, as an only parent. But In my heart, it was like, God, if I could have waited a little while longer. I was crossing 38 to the 40s, you know. And then that 30-something, I could have, you know. I hate to say that. What's that line? I could have been somebody. What's that some line? In
you could have been the contender. I could have been a contender. Yeah. I could have been somebody.
Yes, yes.
But you are somebody, and you have a lovely daughter. So, I mean, I think you got the better end of the stick on that.
Well, at the end of the day, I'm going to sit on my rocker somewhere. I have no idea where I'll be, because I'm not going to stay here in Virginia. And maybe I'm looking at mountains. I will sit in that rocker, most likely with a boyfriend that I see from time to time. This is my vision. And go, you know what, Tara? You did it. You did it. I mean, how many people want to be singers or actors or whatever? And it didn't happen for them. So they're in banking for 30 years. That's fine. But I actually, even if I hadn't started all of this convention and photos and everything, I could still say that in my heart, because I'm a believer to know everybody that, well, there we go. If you want to be a policeman, if you want to be whatever you want to be, go for it. Just like I did with an orange Camaro, $800 and nowhere to live. Just keep going for it, you know, because I had it in my gut. And I would still say that to anybody, you know, any young actor or anything. So I would say it on my rocker and go, I did it. I followed my dream.
And that a lot of people don't do that, and you did. And do you have time for me to ask you about two other projects?
Sure.
I don't think you get asked about this one that often, but you were in two episodes of The Master with Lee Van Cleef.
Right. It was supposed to be, let's see, Michael Sloan producer, and he knew me from Lobo, and he's working with Stephen Connell. That was Stephen Connell. And they brought me, he had to fight for me. He wanted me so bad. And I met with, I don't know, one of the networks. They didn't want me. They wanted somebody else that was still kind of new. And so Timothy Van Patten, is that his name?
Yeah.
That I was supposed to play. Yeah, his girlfriend. I feel like he was just younger, and we didn't like completely, you know, the chemistry. And it was supposed to be for the whole season. Then I did the second episode, and I wasn't doing so well mentally, you know. So I don't know how long that lasted, but it just didn't work out. I wonder if they brought that other girl back in. But Lee was so nice. One of those just, and he played bad guys. But, and also they had the best stunt people or ninja. They had the best ninja stunt people. And Lee was just a doll. Was he my father? I don't remember. No, I think he was dating my mother. Because I just saw pictures of it. I remember a woman. I have
was
no
that,
idea.
I think the Maggie Sinclair was Diana Muldaur.
Oh, well, then there you go. I was her daughter, and I think she was either working with him or dating him. And remember, it was in the first few seasons, so a lot could have gone on after that.
I only think The Master lasted a season. I don't even know if it lasted a full season. It was...
Well,
it's 13 episodes. Yeah, because they got, see, if they would have kept you, it would still be going on today. But now it'd be called, you know, because Lee Van Cleef is dead, you'd be the new ninja warrior, you know, and taking over the whole thing.
Yeah, well, that was my fault. You know, just like I quit, I wanted to quit on whatever episode of Lobo because I thought it was stupid. My manager and the producer said no, but it was I was young. I didn't realize I thought everything would just keep happening, but I thought it was stupid, and so I don't know what was going on and why I did that with there was just on that one. What was the other show?
Well, I'm gonna let you choose between two, so you can pick which one you want to talk about. We can talk about your episode with Buck Rogers. Or we can talk about the movie Night Killer.
Let me just throw this real quick. I have nothing to say about Night Killer because what I do have to say is the Italians came into town. And they came into town when I had moved back here for like 5 years because my daughter didn't. Okay, came from L.A. My whole family's in Virginia. I moved back here so she could know my family. But I couldn't take it after 5 years, and so went back to L.A. In the meantime, an Italian company came into town, and one of my friends, anyway, they sat down and talked to me. I thought that this film, wait, Night Killer. Oh, I'd already done Blue Angel Cafe. Okay. So it was the same Italians. I thought, you know how Clint Eastwood, did the spaghetti westerns,
yes,
and he became famous.
And so did Lee Van Cleef.
Yeah. Okay. Right. But the studios wouldn't, well, of course they hired him, but they didn't want to put him under contract and all that, but that's how he became famous. So silly me thinks, well, this could happen, you know, and in Europe they have a different genre and are more open than the U.S. of what you can show and do. But it was still VHS, and I remember Claudio Gazio de Prosco, something like that, sent me the VHS. I couldn't watch it. So what was the other one?
Well, I will say this, in his defense, from what I've read, he wanted a psychological thriller, and that's what he filmed. And then when they came back, the producers wanted blood and horror in it, and they had another director film those scenes and edit those in. So Claudio Fragoso was unhappy with the production because they filmed and put those scenes in it. So anything with the horrific elements and stuff, that was not what he wanted to do. So just to help you feel better of him, he did not want the end product that you saw.
Oh, I love hearing that, because I felt like it was a psychological thriller. I don't know. I just saw a picture of somebody. I don't know where it's at, a monster in my face, but I hardly remember that. I do remember, because I don't think I had a lot of scenes with whatever that was. He was great. He was kind. He encouraged me. Oh, that is so good to know.
That's what I've read. And so I just want to make sure you if you want to blame the person who did, blame the producers. I don't even want to blame the other director, Bruno Mattei, you know, because he was, you know, he's basically told, go film this, you know. And but the producers or whatever, they are the ones that forced those changes on it. So they moved it from that psychological thriller to what it is today. And I think it would have been better if they would have kept it the psychological thriller, because it would you know, trying to picture it in my mind, like, not with those scenes in it, I think it would have worked so much better.
Well, you know, that's why I'm looking at it, and you do a movie, and you know, you're not working with other actors maybe in another part of the movie, but as the whole, when I saw that, that's not the movie I thought I was making with Claudio. You know, so that is so not the movie that I thought we were making. So therefore, I know you're right. Wow. You know, that's good to know, because he was a good actor's director, you know, serious, not like Hal and comedy, not to say anything about that, but
yeah. Well, I'm glad we were able to help you, help in that, so that way you have your memories of him are better now, and those kind of things. So, you know,
I know. That's great. Because, you know, I think there was a Night Killer picture on the table. Somebody talked about it. Well, now I would have a good story, because usually, no, you can't see that. Yeah, that warms my heart. Thank you for letting me know about that.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. You know, it's nice when you can help people, you know, and hopefully the source I read that from is accurate. You know, you always wonder, you know, when you read these things, but it sounds saying, it all seems to make sense.
Yep. You see a lot of actors, even in terrific films, say, that's not the film that I thought we were making, you know.
Editing can do a lot, and then of course with reshoots, which is what happened to this one, in the editing, it changed the production.
Yeah, and then don't tell you. Yeah, what was the other one you wanna?
Oh,
or
if,
either
if you feel comfortable talking about Buck, I mean, I loved watching Buck Rogers in the 25th Century growing up, and you know, you were an Unchained woman. And, you know, you get to work with Gil Gerard, Aaron Gray, Jamie Lee Curtis, we talked about earlier, you know, and it's, what was it like? Because this is like, it's not Star Trek, but this is like your Star Trek.
Yeah, but it was also earlier than Star Trek series and all that.
No, Star Trek came out in the 60s.
No? Oh, not the movie, but...
No, the Star Trek episodes came out first. They came out in the late 60s, and then the movies came out in the 80s.
Oh, okay. Well, it was just another Universal show, put you in. And, you know, some things are silly, except, you know, I'll always remember working with Jamie. We were just two contract players. I wanted her role. Yeah, I didn't want to be the blonde something. For some reason, I wanted her role, and I don't know what her role was, or anybody's role. There was a guy, I don't know his name, dark-haired, that played my sinister friend or something. I remember him. Gil was, he's still alive, but just arrogant as hell. So, yeah. But nice, nice. I you know, you feel silly in those outfits, you know. You just feel silly. I guess maybe if it was Star Trek, you know, you might really get into the character because you have different kinds of makeup on. But yeah, that was just another show that they, well, still had to audition, you know.
Yeah.
I can't remember who directed. Yeah. But I did too. Just throw something out here.
Okay.
On a Quincy.
Oh, I love Quincy.
Sometimes, and this was what I love about directors or like Michael Sloan wanting me to, fighting for me and the master. Well, I had a small part and I interviewed a guy named Corey Allen. And he was a director and he was in Rebel with Cause, Rebel with Cause. What's the name of it? With James Dean.
Rebel Without a Cause?
Yeah, Rebel with Cause. And it was a scene small in the opening where I was a young girl that had had a botched abortion. And I ran into this clinic and help me. And then I ended up dying. So that was a the theme for the Quincy episode, which I can't remember what it was.
Oh, physician. But, physician, heal thyself.
Heal thyself. Wow. So Corey Allen saw something in that little bit and brought me in to do another Quincy. Can't remember that, but I was terrible in it. Bigger role. But then he brought me in to do the man in the Santa Claus suit, mm-hmm. you know,
yep.
with the Fred Astaire. So because they... And Ray Danton did this. I've worked with him, too. They fall in love with your work. I mean, your work, they fall in love, you know. You can fall in love with an actor's style, you know. I don't know if they're falling in love with them. But that's what I love. And I had to throw that out there. Because sometimes, you know, I mean, it does lead into another as these movie stars work with the same director and... You know, bad, but I'll always remember that because it started out as a teeny weeny role, and somebody saw something, you know.
And as you said, that's what it takes. Like you went in there and they had your picture on the wall. It's like I want that girl, you know. I want her, you know. It's somebody sees a scene and they're just like, that's the person I had pictured in my mind for this role. And the next thing you know, you get that role, and then. One line role goes to a multiple line role, which then moves to a co-starring role. And then, they, you know, and that's how it's great.
Yeah. So those stories in hindsight, looking and being able to tell them and thinking about it still bring me back to that theme of some actors in the world get two lines, you know, in a movie and are still trying for it years later. But I guess, my theory is hang in there because you never know, you know. But yeah, I love that about that kind of work, you know, because we see into each other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, an actor, well, for me, there's all kinds. There's the one that just want to look pretty on screen and marry rich and an executive producer and be known. For me, the way we were with Barbara Streisand and Chris Christopherson, was living in Virginia. I hadn't moved yet, probably 19. Yeah, I was 19 because I moved at 20. Came on, I watched it, and I gut-wrenched, sobbed on the floor, dying, because I felt those scenes. I mean, I had to play the role. I had to emote. You know, you're childhood isn't always happy, and so you can understand a character. I didn't get those roles, you know, but that's why I went into it. because it lets you bring up something. Worked with a producer in Beretta, Planet Jesus Freak. I had to cry a lot. Cry. I don't know if he told me to cry, but it was a good scene. And then I was out of tears. And then he took me aside and he said, Tara, do you remember? I can't remember. F. Do you remember when Robert F. Kennedy was shot or something? And I did remember it and started sobbing and went back into the scene, you know? So that's what I love, you know? Wow, I wish I could feel that today, you know, or do something like that, that they could pull it out of you and you can remember it and do it, you know. But I didn't get to do that, you know, in that era. I'm sure I would have later, but yeah, like I said, end of the day, I worked.
And that's the key thing, yeah, I think, especially at that time. You know, it might not be the role they exactly want, but it's a role that could lead to the role that you want. And
right.
And, you know, you keep trying, you keep plugging away. And
well, I mean, it's like, okay, so I start this, really? I'm talking about Silent Night, Deadly Night. Never would I talk about. Talking about a part on Beretta. You see what I mean? So it's, again, the little things touch somebody. You know, even though you say, well, that's not really me, but it touched them or they saw something in it. So mm-hmm. that you get rewarded by that, as they do.
I think so, too. And you're going to be at a convention in November, which is going to be a couple of weeks after this episode goes out, because this episode will be going out later in October. And if you want to let people know what the convention is and when it's going to be happening.
Yeah, it's, I wrote it down. I'm going to give you the website if that's okay.
Sure.
www. And it's all one word here. SalemParacom.org. So SalemParacom.org. Now it's November 11th and 12th. Now I met this guy at the convention and briefly talked about it. And since I'm new to this, I do have a signing agent, and he was going to talk to him, but I don't think my signing agent does this. But anyway, I went ahead and accepted. And you know why? Because I really don't know what the convention's about. I mean, I don't know what the layout is. I don't know, you know, the Maryland with the Martin Grimes conventions, they're very different and very respected, as I'm sure others are. But you'll have different fans here. It's paranormal and psychics. And I've wanted a reading forever. I love that. I like the paranormal. I love and believe in, you know, certain psychics, but I'm sure these are pretty professional. But they're having a guest star, a mentalist, and then I'm an honor guest or something that not a psychic, but I guess they're promoting me on like horror, Silent Night, Deadly Night, and all the other stuff there. So he says he only brings like one person of a different from the outside, and he's just super nice, and it's Salem, Massachusetts. So I wish I had time to go to the museum, mm-hmm. you know. So that's what I'm going to do, and we'll see what happens. I'm sure it'll be fun.
So, listeners, if you want to meet her like I got to meet her, you know where she's going to be now. She's going to be in Salem, Massachusetts, November 11th and the 12th for the Paracon, you know, the paranormal convention. So go to you. That'll be the website that she gave you will be in the show notes. If you want to click, you can click the link and go straight to the information that's there and go out and visit her.
Yeah, Salem Paracon. Yeah. Well, thanks for letting me do that, because, you know, this is all new to me. So.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for allowing me to talk with you for 90 minutes about your career and your different TV and movies, which we didn't even come close to hitting all the credits. I mean, it's amazing how much stuff you did in that period of time. And I'm glad we were able to help give you some better memories with Night Killer. Yeah. You know, so when somebody comes up to talk to you about it, you can at least say, well, we filmed it this way, but that it was pulled from the director.
Wow. Fascinating. Yeah, you're just a pleasure to talk to. And then I read about you, and I even admire your work and, you know, your past life, not in another world. But, yeah, it's been a pleasure. I feel comfortable with you. So thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome. Hope everybody enjoyed that episode. And again, I wanted to thank Ms. Buckman for allowing me to interview her. It was a pleasure to meet her at the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention. If you have any feedback, please send it to us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. We're closing in on episode 200. So if you have any feedback for that episode, please send it to us and I'll add it to that episode. So you'll be able to hear your feedback then. I hope everybody has a good day, and thank you for listening. And on our way out, we're going to listen to a promo for a podcast that I really enjoyed, done by my friends Rich and Jeff, and that's the Classic Horrors Club podcast. So let's end the episode with you guys listening to that. Everybody have a good day. Bye.
Hi, I'm Jeff Owens.
And I'm Richard Chamberlain. And we want you to join our club, the Classic Horrors Club.
Every month, Richard and I host the Classic Horrors Club podcast, where we talk about our favorite subject, horror movies.
Some of them are classics.
We all go a little mad sometimes.
And some definitely aren't.
What you see is real. What's done is done, and what I've done is right. It's the work of science.
But we love them all the same. We also have special theme months where we highlight the legendary stars.
And we head to the drive-ins of the past every summer for exciting double and triple features.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle.
And we even have occasional guests.
My obsession, and it is truly an obsession, I suppose, of Frankenstein, the true story, dates back to when it first aired in two parts on NBC in 1973.
So join the fun and listen to the Classic Horrors Club podcast today. Hosted by SoundCloud, we're available wherever fine podcasts are found. And for even more fun, check out the video companion on our YouTube channel.
And remember,
we sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment.